This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Japonica Brown of Boston University. Japonica recently came out with her new book with the University of Chicago Press, How Place Makes Us, Novel LBQ Identities in Four Small Cities. Thank you for joining us, Japonica.
It's great to be here.
Tell us about your book.
So the book is about the lives and communities and identities of lesbian, bisexual, and queer identified individuals in four small U.S. cities, Ithaca, New York, Greenfield, Massachusetts, Portland, Maine, and San Luis Obispo, California. And I can tell you more if you're curious, but I set out to write a book that was about gentrification and why LBQ individuals continue to concentrate in these smaller cities that tend to be politically progressive, have a college or university, and have lots of natural amenities. But sort of midway through researching, or about two-thirds of the way through, I was sort of hit over the head by the degree to which the individuals I was studying in each of these cities were talking about who they were in terms of their sexual identity and difference in ways that were incredibly distinct from city to city. And so the book is exploring how and why there are these city-specific ways of understanding sexual identity and difference or unique sexual identity cultures in each place.
Can you give us some examples of how they're different?
Sure. So in one city, San Luis Obispo, California, almost everyone that I talked with identified as lesbian, regardless of her past romantic or sexual history. Their social lives were oriented around other lesbians. The lives that they were living looked to me sort of like lesbian community, as I'd always heard it described, but not, couldn't possibly actually exist anywhere. And then in Ithaca, New York, in total contrast, almost everyone I spoke with resisted identifying with their sexual identity. They were very out about their sexual difference, about, you know, partnering with another woman, for instance, but did not want to be thought of through the lens of sexual identity. Wanted to be thought of in terms of professional identity or parenting, something related to life speed or, you know, their work with composting education or their hiking or running. And so I argue that this is more of a post-identity politics orientation. And I'll stop there for now. But in each city, there was this very distinctive way of thinking about, you know, who one is and of interacting with those around oneself.
Well, you know, Japonica, one of the things that I think is really great is that you steered away from like the, you know, the low hanging fruit of like Brooklyn, San Francisco, you know, yada, 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 like the cities that the big cities that everyone always studies. Right. And decided to focus on these smaller, like less research cities. And I wonder why did you decide to do that?
So it was kind of an accident. My first book was about gentrification, and two of the places that I had studied had very large LGBTQ populations. And one of them, Andersonville in Chicago, was sort of known when I began fieldwork as the Swedish / lesbian neighborhood. In fact, when I arrived, there had just been this big debate in the community about what the neighborhood streetscape should look like. The city was giving them money to redesign their streetscape, and they were debating whether it would be a Swedish or a lesbian-themed streetscape.
What does a lesbian streetscape look like?
Yeah, I was wondering.
Well, like, I can imagine a Swedish streetscape. <Yeah.
laughs> That was their argument for going with Swedes instead of lesbians. They couldn't figure out what it would look like.
Yeah.
But anyway, when I started field work there, I would I was studying gentrification, so I'd ask people, tell me about how the neighborhood has changed, why do you think it's changed? And people would talk about the role of lesbians as change agents. Mm-hmm. You know, no matter who I was talking with, that was front and center in their narratives about the neighborhood. But 5 years later, when I was finishing fieldwork, gay men had started to move into the neighborhood in more significant numbers. And I was really struck by how narratives very swiftly changed to give those gay men nearly all the credit and blame for the gentrification that was happening. Mm-hmm. And queer women were sort of erased from the narrative. So as I was thinking about a second book project, I started to think, well, I want to understand more about the role of queer female populations in gentrification. And to do this, I needed to figure out where queer female populations concentrated. And there were these wonderful analyses of 2000 census data that said that actually lesbian couple migration was most oriented to these small cities with lots of natural amenities. These are actually places that are quite popular with retirees as well. And I happened to be living in Ithaca, New York, while I was reading these analyses. And this light bulb sort of went off for me. I thought, why are these individuals still concentrating in these cities? We have a story of lesbians migrating to places like Northampton, Massachusetts in the 70s and 80s, but how do we explain that sustained migration today? Mm-hmm. And what happens to these cities once these individuals move to them? How do they change them? So that's what I thought I was going to be exploring. Mm-hmm.
One thing that I love is this idea of identity really being mediated by place. And what's the mechanism there? Like, what makes a, you know, what makes an, like, what's the process by which the Ithaca LBQ community is different from the Portland, Maine?
Portland, Maine. Yeah. Sure. So, ultimately, I can't tell you how much time I spent, first settling on the idea that it was cities that were shaping the identities. Mm-hmm. I rely on what Jack Katz describes as a process of eliminating negative explanations. Uh-huh. And eventually I settled on cities as shaping these identities. And then I had to figure out what it was about the cities that was shaping identities. And ultimately, I say that there are three core mechanisms that are sort of loose bundles of elements of city ecology are at work here. And the first, and in some ways the most defining, is what I call abundance and acceptance, which is basically the proportion of the local population that identifies as LBQ, the degree to which residents feel safe and accepted. And this includes, you know, hate crime rates, but also how many churches are welcoming institutions. And this mechanism really directs people toward or away from identity politics. And the cities where LBQ residents feel surrounded by other people like them and safe and accepted, they're least likely to put their sexual identity front and center in terms of how they understand themselves and how they make decisions about forging social relationships. But that's not the only thing that happens. I also suggest that place narratives are another crucial mechanism. So broader stories that the cities tell about who they are sort of instruct residents on who and how to be in a place, which is part of why two cities that look very similar in terms of abundance and acceptance nonetheless have really distinctive versions of identity politics or of post-identity politics. And just to give a little example of that, you know, I described San Luis Obispo residents as identifying, you know, very clearly as lesbian. And in Portland, Maine, identity politics is alive and well, but it's a very different kind of identity politics. So I met individual after individual who had these very long hyphenated self-descriptions that were as important to them as the lesbian label in San Luis Obispo, but instead it would be like queer, poly, femme, dyke, for instance. And, you know, many different versions of this. So the last mechanism that is at work is what I call socioscape, which is basically the social characteristics of the place and particularly of the LBQ population. And this isn't working in the way we usually think about place demographics shaping identity. So it's not about any major differences in the racial or economic or educational characteristics of residents, but instead very subtle differences in those characteristics, like what kinds of elite liberal arts colleges the individuals I studied went to in one city versus another, mm-hmm. and the habits they develop in the place of talking about the significance of that kind of education.
Can I ask a clarifying question? So you said they went to elite liberal arts schools, but you know, some of these places you know, have big publics, right? So San Luis Obispo has Cal Poly, which is, you know, kind of a middle ranked California public institution. Did the residents you talked to, were they Cal Poly alums, or had they gone to like Occidental College or something like that and then moved up north to San Luis Obispo?
In San Luis Obispo, it was a mix in terms of the kinds of institutions that individuals went to. So Greenfield and Portland were really sort of the places where there was just this tremendous pool of people who had gone to small elite liberal arts colleges. Mm-hmm. San Luis Obispo, there actually weren't that many Cal Poly individuals in my sample. It was much more of a story of people migrating north from LA, mm-hmm. south from San Francisco, or coming out of the Central Valley, trying to get to the coast, but feeling priced out of Santa Barbara and Santa Cruz, for instance.
Yeah, I can see why. I've had that fantasy myself about living up there.
It's a good fantasy.
Well, so So Japonica, so Gabriel's question actually kind of touches on my question, which in thinking about what you were saying, my mind goes in directions that are usually not related, but I think could be related. So I was thinking, so I was actually thinking about Jimenez's immigrant replenishment thesis, right? And I'm like wondering whether or not, you know, sort of the type of identity and the type of culture that basically gets created among the LBQ community, whether or not that also depends on if, you know, that identity is mostly contained and informed by locals, right? So whether or not local means you went to, you know, the liberal arts institution that's within the community and then you end up staying and becoming part of that community, or if you come from far away because you've heard about this community, you think that it might be a great place to like live and be who you are, but you are coming in with these like different notions of what it means to be you and what it means to be L or B or Q.
So that's a great question, and it's one I thought about a lot. And I actually don't think that that's sort of a big part of the story. I found that most of the people had moved to these cities for reasons very unrelated to sort of the narrow ways they end up thinking about who they are in terms of sexual identity. So they move for a job at the university, or they transfer from Boston to Portland for a new position. Many move to be around family members or because a partner had an opportunity. And many, many, many had expressed surprise and sometimes disappointment about the identity culture they found in the new place. Sometimes they felt very constrained by the ways the people around them were identifying, but couldn't find a way out in terms of they felt themselves shifting after their move in ways they never expected. And then on top of that, many of them have moved from the same places. So there are lots of Brooklyn migrants in my sample, for instance. There are lots of people who've spent time in Northampton and Boston. I mean, down to like very specific neighborhoods, Boston's Jamaica Plain. There were people, certainly in all three of the East Coast places that I studied, who'd all spent time there. And so I don't think this is a story of people moving, sort of knowing what identity they're going to find there, nor do I think it's a story of people transporting identities with them as they move. And I actually have an article with Jeffrey Parker in Sexualities that's about how we argue that the idea that a place is lesbian friendly sort of masks this more subtle or nuanced understanding of what identity is actually going to be like on the ground in the city, so that it's sort of enough to know that it's going to be a friendly place to live, and that gets people there, and then they arrive and they're surprised by the ways in which the place sort of asks them to adjust how they think about who they are.
I really liked one thing that I really liked about your paper was this, you know, this idea that maybe we underestimate how central place is to identity, and maybe tend to essentialize the LGBT community, and maybe overestimate how central sexuality is to their identities.
I think that's right. And I'm somewhat guilty of this. The first article I published out of this project was after I had done field work in Ithaca. And I wrote about how, you know, queer women moving to this city, adopting a post-identity politics orientation, then struggled with a sense of loneliness and a sense of loss of community. And I sort of surmised that this was a broad pattern that we would find in other places. And so I was guilty of thinking about LGBTQ individuals in this same way, I think. The first article that I published from the project was based on fieldwork I did in Ithaca, which was the first site that I studied. And there I found a post-identity politics orientation among almost everyone that I interviewed. And I argued that this post-identity politics orientation created a sense of loss and loneliness. These individuals had moved to this place that they knew to be full of other LGBTQ individuals. And then because no one was identifying as lesbian, they felt like they couldn't find them. And I surmised that this was a broad pattern, that we would find this in other places. But then because I had studied these four cities that shared so many ecological traits and that had population groups that shared so many demographic traits, you know, the variation between them really called me out of that framework for thinking about queer identities in the contemporary moment.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.